I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Hello and welcome to Material Girls, a pop culture podcast that uses critical theory to understand the zeitgeist. I'm Marcel Cosman.
And I'm Hannah McGregor, and I am here to confess that Marcel has absolutely broken me, and I'm fully prepared to become a Disney adult. Marcel, why would you do this to me?
It's an exact quote, people. I quoted Hannah McGregor's text to me, word for word. We are obviously going to talk about Disney in this episode, but I thought that it would be helpful if in the introductory segment, we just get off our chest the reasons why we might be compelled to become Disney adults, having just returned from a trip to the happiest place on earth. So yeah, Hannah, you tell me, why did I do that to you?
What a good question. Well, Marcel, I've known about your deep love for Disney since 2017. Is that the first year you went?
I think it's 2018.
2018. It was the same trip that you and I went to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, which was the first and until recently last theme park I'd ever been to. And you were coming off a Disney trip and you were
changed.
You were changed. You kept talking about how like you couldn't wait to get back to Disney. And then you went back to Disney again. And then through the pandemic, like you kept talking about how all you wanted to do was go back to Disney. And truly, I just was like, well, whatever makes Marcel happy, that's fine. But like, I had no history with Disneyland, no prior particular opinions one way or the other, like really no knowledge at all. I was like vaguely aware that Disney adults were a thing. And I obviously like knew that these theme parks existed, but like had never even considered going to them. And then you said that for your 40th birthday, you wanted to go to Disneyland with Elliot and you invited me to come along. And you know, I love being included.
And now look who's changed.
I guess I'm changed. I guess I'm different now. Here's the thing that really has like struck me in the wake of this trip is it is such an intensely immersive and honestly overstimulating space.
Oh, yeah.
That my like, you know, super overactive, constantly going brain, which like never stops thinking about work, is like always like making to-do lists in the back of my head, always like anxious about things. There was no room for anything but what was happening. Like there just wasn't. I truly stopped thinking about work for a week, which is unheard of, a miracle. And when I got back to work, I thought that I would feel like resentful and mad about returning to the real world, which, you know, I partially did because work sucks.
Totally. Yeah, same.
But I also felt like so refreshed. Like, I couldn't believe how much more patience I had with everyone and like how much less irritated I was by emails, because I had just honestly gotten to spend a week just having just no real responsibilities.
Yeah.
Really making hard decisions like, what ride should we go on next? And have I had too much popcorn today?
It's true. It's true. It was a phenomenal trip. And I know that that's not what we're here to talk about, which is why I wanted to talk about it now.
Yeah, we have to mention it here so that we can write off the trip on our taxes.
It was for research.
Well, now that I got all that joy off my chest, I'm ready to ask the serious materialist question. What are or were the historical, ideological, and material conditions for our object of study to become zeitgeisty? Wow, Marcel, why is Disney so big?
Hang on to your Mickey ears and Maleficent horns and other mini-style ear hats, people, because I'm going to go rogue.
What?
I know, it's very uncharacteristic of me, but I was doing my research about whether or not Disney was guilty of pinkwashing, and it kind of dawned on me that I don't think that Disney is zeitgeisty. I think pinkwashing is the thing that's zeitgeisty.
Oh yeah, actually, you know what? Really checks out. Are we going to talk about Disney at all?
Yeah, we're totally going to talk about Disney, but I think we need to talk about the zeitgeistiness of pinkwashing, where it comes from, what it is, etc.
Can't wait.
In order to do that, we have to acknowledge that when people say pinkwashing, they might be referring to one of two things. So often people will use the term in reference to the Pink Ribbon campaign.
That's like the breast cancer awareness campaign. So in that case, is pinkwashing like the look good, feel better campaign when they told women with breast cancer to put on makeup?
I think that's a great example of it. Yeah. It's also like generally it's like when companies disingenuously brand their products pink for breast cancer awareness while neglecting to reveal that those products contain carcinogenic chemicals, for example.
While neglecting to say that actually they aren't aware of breast cancer at all.
True. So there was one example where the NFL was branded pink for the fine month of October, and its tagline was like, catch it early or something. It was about mammograms. And so then like people who are actually in the like breast cancer research area were like, hang on, you're neglecting a lot of stuff here when you just tell people to get mammograms and that's going to do it. Like, that's not enough. This is misinformation. So I would encourage any listeners who are curious to learn more about the exploitation of the Pink Ribbon campaign to check out Karuna Jagger's article for the Huffington Post called Think Before You Pink, Stop the Distraction.
Sounds great. Sounds great, Marcel, but I do need to interrupt you here. So, you know, we're talking about pink washing, but I feel like I hear the word washing applied to a lot of things. So maybe we start there rather than with the significance of the color pink. What does it mean to wash something?
Exactly. And so, Hannah, as you were saying, it's become pretty common to combine a term with hyphen washing in order to draw attention to like sketchy marketing cover-up practices, right? So the OED defines the process of combining a term with washing as, quote, forming nouns referring to the presentation of a company, product, person, etc., as associated with the social stance, cause, etc., indicated by the first element, see note, in order to influence public opinion in a way regarded as unfounded or intentionally misleading, end quote.
Okay, so I feel like the one that I hear a lot lately is greenwashing, which is like a company rebranding themselves or like doing initiatives that make them sound environmentally friendly, but that's not actually like based in reality.
Yeah, it's like there's nothing sustainable about the practice. It just sounds good.
Yeah, so is pinkwashing like breast cancer awareness first? Is that where that term comes from?
Yes. So
yes, starts with breast cancer.
Yes.
That's the original pink.
Yes. Okay. Well, so this is the first use of the term as recorded by the OED, right? So that's always the caveat. But starting around like 2011, the term pinkwashing starts to get used to refer to dubious queer inclusion or dubious queer inclusivity, like around the pride stuff, like when your bank is all of a sudden like, we love gays for 1 month every year.
Yeah. Or like your beer company.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, ooh, yeah. Ooh, rainbow cans. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, guys.
So, Hannah, would you believe that this use of the term pinkwashing actually comes from the anti-Zionist movement?
I was spoiled on this detail by Instagram, like, this week. But boy, did it blow my mind.
So mind-blowing,
like,
right?
Like, absolutely blew my mind.
Yeah.
I had no idea that pinkwashing is a term that originated from, like, the way that the state of Israel uses, like, LGBTQ plus inclusion as, like, a Zionist marketing tactic.
I know. It's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So the origin of the term pinkwashing for this purpose starts around 2011, when the queer Jewish activist, writer, and scholar Sarah Shulman wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called Israel and Pinkwashing.
And everybody was like, wow, this op-ed's going to be about how Israel supports breast cancer awareness.
So in this article, Shulman argues that Israel's, just like you were saying, Hannah, Israel's gay-friendly reputation was a deliberate part of a marketing campaign designed to make the country appear more progressive than specifically its predominantly Islamic neighbors. Okay, so to quote the article, quote, the growing global gay movement against the Israeli occupation has named these tactics pinkwashing, a deliberate strategy to conceal the continuing violations of Palestinians' human rights behind an image of modernity signified by Israeli gay life, end quote. So Shulman then clarifies further that the success of Israel's pinkwashing campaign was a means not only to cover up its own human rights abuses, but also to minimize the existence of a gay rights movement in Palestine. And this is something that we totally saw, like, after the October 7th attacks, where people were like, well, also the Palestinians hate gays and women.
Oh, yeah. No, I've had a number of people say to me with a kind of vicious satisfaction that I would be murdered in Palestine.
That's right.
Which is, one, not the slam dunk that people seem to think it is in terms of argumentation, but two is, you know, like, so obviously tied up in this Islamophobic narrative in which, like, leftist or progressive culture is impossible in, like, majority Muslim states.
Totally.
Which is racist, just in case people don't get the subtext of that. That's what that is.
Yeah, just to be clear, that's racist.
So in this case, why pink? I mean, why not rainbow washing? Why pink washing?
Well, Hannah, do you know about the pink triangles?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Pink triangles are the thing that the Nazis made gay men wear in concentration camps.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So,
it's a Holocaust reference.
It is. Yeah. And so for folks who are unfamiliar with the history of the Pink Triangle and how it came to be affiliated with the gay rights movement, I would recommend a short but really thorough article for Time by Olivia B. Waxman called how the Nazi regime's pink triangle symbol was repurposed for LGBTQ pride. In short, gay men in Nazi concentration camps were marked with pink triangles in the same way that Jews were marked with yellow stars of David. And so the pink triangle has thus come to symbolize in the queer community surviving tremendous oppressive violence. And given that the State of Israel was founded after the Holocaust for survivors of the Holocaust to have a safe place to go to, the accusation of pinkwashing to cover up its own human rights abuses is a very precise and deliberate phrasing.
Gotcha. Hence pinkwashing instead of rainbow washing.
Exactly.
Okay. But it's really spread beyond Israel.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And reasonably so. So anytime we use the term pinkwashing, we must remember that we owe a debt of gratitude to the queers of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, Free Palestine, Ceasefire Now and Forever, Land Back, Free Palestine.
Right, hey, you know what?
Yeah.
Fuck colonialism.
Yeah, any opportunity to talk about why colonialism is the worst. So let's talk about pinkwashing in our own colonial state.
Hannah. Because we do love that. Here. And you know what? Our neighbors to the south, also big fans.
Big fans. So Hannah, if you were to think of, say, two recent big corporate pinkwashing campaigns, do any two come to mind?
Okay. So here are the two that I feel like I have heard discussed the most on the lefty podcasts that are the vast majority of media that I consume. Because that's mostly where I get all of my information. One is Target. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I feel like Target has been discussed in the past year because they sort of did a big corporate, like, pride marketing thing. And then when they got, like, I was about to say pushback from, like, the right, but, like, it was, like, bomb threats. Like threats of violence, people going into Target locations and like screaming at and threatening employees and, you know, quite scary pushback. They either pulled the line or like took it out of stores so it was only available online in a way that like a lot of queer activists were like, this is actually worse. Like it's worse for you to like claim to do this like big sort of marketing campaign where you're like, we love the LGBTQ plus community unless people with guns tell us not to. And then actually, psych, we don't love you at all, which is like a really bad precedent to set.
We'll love you in secret.
We'll love you in secret, but not out loud because, I mean, like, I get it. Like, part of it is that I get it because, like, Target employees are not paid enough to fucking deal with that. And also, it's like, cool, well, I guess if we focus our political inclusion campaigns on what corporations are doing, then we're fucked because corporations are fundamentally cowardly. And then the other one, wasn't there a big thing with Budweiser where they like did a campaign where they gave influencers customized cans and I think they gave this like prominent trans TikToker her own like custom can and then the conservatives found out about it and started, I think, shooting cans of Budweiser with guns.
I mean, they were doing that anyway. Let's be real. They do that for Target practice.
Oh, but I think they were full. I think they indicated the anger by shooting the full cans.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm really just getting this news filtered to me through like Michael Hobbs predominantly.
So the essential thing, I think, like what the angry people were doing specifically is less important for our purposes than the fact that both Target and Budweiser were like, oh, that was a mistake. Whoop.
Yeah.
Not going to do that anymore. Which you're right. Like employee safety is important and it's not a zero sum kind of thing. It's not like, well, in order to protect our employees' safety, we then have to disavow all relationship to the LGBTQ plus community. Because, hey, some of those employees, probably gay.
I know. That's the wild thing. Not mutually exclusive.
So this was last June, fairly recent, and yet still manages to feel like 10 years ago. These are two really good examples of how flimsy corporate support for the queer community is. And I found an episode of NPR's Fresh Air that addressed exactly those two instances.
Leftist podcasts.
So NPR, hosted by Ari Shapiro. Hannah, could I get you to please read Shapiro's introduction to that episode?
Absolutely. Quote, only a few years ago, companies were often accused of pinkwashing during Pride Month, pretending to support LGBTQ+ people while doing little or nothing behind the scenes. Well, now, as more states pass anti-trans and anti-gay laws, some companies are pulling back even from the appearance of support. Bud Light and Target both faced conservative backlash and took action to appease those critics, end quote. So, like, we've got on one level, like, the critique of pinkwashing as, like, you're making these campaigns where you claim that you support LGBTQ+ people, but like, you're not actually doing anything substantive that's actually helping. Like, you're not pushing laws or policies that will support trans people, for example. And then we get like a pretty clear example of how only skin deep these forms of seeming support are, because as soon as somebody pushes back, they're like, never mind.
Yeah. So zeitgeistily speaking, we're in a weird place because pinkwashing just is super commonplace. And having meaningful inclusion of queer folks in the brand marketing. So like, for example, when Anheuser-Busch hired Dylan Mulvaney to like be the poster girl for their shitty beer, like that was too much. And that caused a conservative backlash that was so frightening that Anheuser-Busch then canceled her contract. So what's weird is that, yeah, pinkwashing is everywhere, constant, really popular, zeitgeisty. And yet there are certain things that cause, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here. God damn it.
I mean, I think zeitgeisty things can also be the object of significant concentrated cultural hate.
Yes.
Right? Like, in the zeitgeist, it's in the air, it's very popular, people are talking about it a lot. Part of why people are talking about it is that there is a significant conservative backlash against it. But like, there was significant conservative backlash against Barbie, because it was too feminist for a lot of people, right? So like, what is tricky is, I think, a lot of the time, like when we're used to critiquing a thing on the left, like particularly in this case, when it's like a term we came up with, you know, we speaking generally as like queer leftist cultural critics, it's a term we came up with. And then when people who hate us are like, we don't want this thing that you've critiqued to be possible, we're like, well, maybe we do want pinkwashing. No, we don't. But I guess it's better than this.
Yeah. So, and I think that that's sort of the undercurrent of Shapiro's sort of introduction that I had you read there, which is like, and now we can't even have pinkwashing, which I don't, to be clear, I don't think he's saying.
No, and it's not useful. Like, what this is ultimately demonstrating is the fact that pinkwashing is washing, that it like hasn't addressed any of the rot that lies beneath.
Exactly. The dead flies,
yeah,
if you will.
And the spider webs and the chicken shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of chicken shits involved in this.
Have I got you convinced then that pinkwashing is the zeitgeist?
I'm certainly convinced that pinkwashing is a zeitgeisty topic, maybe in a sort of not more popular than Disney, but more zeitgeisty than Disney.
Yeah, definitely. But never fear, we shall still talk about whether or not Disney is involved in pinkwashing.
Oh, thank God. Because we did so much research. We pointed at every Pride-themed thing that we saw.
I even took a few pictures. So, okay, it's important to point out for listeners who are devotedly anti-Disney, as I was before I was changed, that Disney does in fact have branded Pride merch available all year long. So it's not just a June thing. It's a, you can always celebrate Pride at Disney kind of thing. And some of its content is also legitimately inclusive. And a lot of that is subtext, like my favorite example, which is that Elsa is absolutely asexual. But some of it is also text. For example, there are two Pixar Spark shorts on Disney Plus. One is called Out and one is called Float. And both of these are stories about loving your queer children for their queerness and not despite it.
Did they make you cry?
Obviously. Good. Sobbed.
Okay.
Sobbed.
Okay. You know what I would find really personally useful, Marcel, is if like a queer media outlet had compiled a definitive ranking of Disney's live action and animated LGBTQ plus characters.
Hannah, guess what? I have some news that you will feel ambivalent about. The queer media outlet Pink News.
Oh, no.
Has indeed published an article called A Definitive Ranking of Disney's Live Action and Animated LGBTQ Character Firsts.
Okay.
But it is far from definitive. There are only 10 characters, and they leave out Elsa and the other obviously queer character, Maleficent. Like, how? Anyway.
I mean, this is outrageous. Maleficent is entirely about queer desire, but fine.
Fine.
Way to not know how to read your own movies.
Mm-hmm.
So they're only including canonically LGBTQ plus characters in this list?
No, that was what I wondered as well. And no, the answer is no, because they also include these like vague sort of blink and you miss them characters. Like there's an antelope couple in Zootopia, Bucky and Pronk Oryx Antlerson. And there's a purportedly lesbian couple that you can see even in the Finding Dory trailer, but okay. Like, no. Anyway, I digress. Despite the glaring omissions, the list has reminded me of some of the granular strides that Disney films have made towards inclusion. Hannah, have you seen any of the following? Elemental, Onward, Lightyear, or Strange World?
I think that I've seen... I really struggle with these one-word Disney titles. Is Onward the one where two brothers go on a quest?
I actually don't know. I haven't seen any of them.
Okay, I think I might have seen Onward and Strange World. I definitely have not seen Elemental or Lightyear, but I think I've seen the other two, if they are the movies I'm thinking of.
I mean, we are currently struggling right now. Listeners right now who have seen these movies are screaming.
Yeah, listen, we've got a heart out, so we're not pausing to Google.
Yeah, it's too bad.
We can talk about it in the comments on Instagram or something.
I mean, I did do some Google, but that was before. So all four of these films have canonically LGBTQ plus characters who we know in watching the film. We have evidence, we have textual evidence watching the films are queer, but more importantly, as far as I'm concerned, they are played by out LGBTQ plus actors.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think like probably the one that people may have heard the most buzz about is that Lightyear has a lesbian side character named Alicia Hawthorne, who's played by Uzo Aduba, and she kisses her partner in the movie. And this was like...
That's huge.
A big thing because Disney pulled the kiss because of backlash, and then reinstated the kiss because of employee backlash.
Oh.
I know.
Ooh, we're going to get into that more, right? This like employee versus audience backlash thing?
I think so, yeah. Because ultimately our question when it comes to queer content, is it just slow granular progress or is it just... no pun intended, lip service there to make Disney look progressive and distract us from its otherwise harmful business practices.
Ooh, and Marcel, that feels like a really complex question. Can you answer it for me, please?
With a little help from my friends.
Your friend's theory?
Maybe.
Okay. Okay, people, listen up. This is the segment in which Marcel will introduce us to some good old-fashioned theory that'll help us determine what exactly Disney is up to.
Okay, Hannah, I'm really sorry, but here's the thing. I went rogue again.
Marcel, why do we even have a format if you're not going to follow it?
I did conduct research, I swear. But as I was reading about Disney and its business practices, I was like, whoa, I do not have the toolkit to analyze corporate business practice. So the theory that I have brought is not a theory.
Is it like corporate analysis?
It's all kind of.
Okay.
Kind of. It's municipal analysis.
Oh, no.
So I'm drawing on an article by Karine Duplan called Pinkwashing Policies or Insider Activism, Allyship in the LGBTIQ plus Governance Activism Nexus.
Ooh, a nexus.
A nexus. And in this article, Duplan looks at what leads to making public spaces inclusive for queer and trans folks. She's not looking at marketing, but rather at public policy for queering urban spaces.
Okay, that's interesting because I think maybe we can have a conversation maybe in the third segment about like Disney as a public-private space.
Yeah, maybe.
But like, is she looking at like Anaheim?
She's writing about Geneva in Switzerland.
Okay.
Because despite its reputation, you may have heard of her. In the context of LGBTQ plus rights, it's remained really conservative and only recently made significant moves towards queer inclusivity and equality.
Okay. You've written into the script me saying that that's weirdly similar to Disney, but I don't think it is.
It is. Okay, fine. All right. Well, you might not think that that's weirdly similar to Disney, but I think it is. And what I found particularly useful about this article, despite having zero background in ethnographic research, was Duplan's argument that public policy officials, quote, act towards a discrete queering of municipal governance from the inside, end quote.
Okay, that does make me think about the conversations we've been having about Disney.
Okay, so she explores a phenomenon called nexus politics that, quote, accounts for the connection of alternative forms of political participation with conventional politics, end quote. So in other words, the presence of queers and queer allies in government allows us to think beyond a pinkwashing / authentic activism binary and see instead, quote, the ongoing dialogue between activist collectives and public officials that join their forces together to increase the visibility of queer lives and concerns and improve access to public spaces and services for those whose gender or sexual orientation might still be considered as an impediment, end quote. An impediment to accessing those spaces.
Yeah, to public participation. So can we apply the same nexus, whatever it means, politics lens when we look at how a conservative multinational corporation like Disney is making space for queer representation?
I sure as heck hope so, because that's what I'm doing. because it seems to me, having read this article and understood most of it with a lot of effort, it seems to come down to having queer and queer allied employees, which is something that Disney does have a lot of just by the fact of being one of the biggest employers in the world. It employs like 75,000 people in Florida alone.
Yeah. It's not just that it's a big employer and so we'll have, like, I would guess that it maybe has a slightly above average, like literally the average amount of queer employees because it employs a lot of artists.
Totally. And I'll give you like a fun tidbit of information. In 1995, Disney started offering health benefits to employee same-sex partners. So that makes it one of the first in the U.S. to do so. And so if this is a company where you know that your same-sex partner will have access to health benefits, you are going to try to work there.
Absolutely.
So even company policy,
that's like specifically,
you know,
attracting, like that is a policy that attracts more queer people to work with your company.
Totally. Absolutely. So yeah, so Disney has a Pride collection. It's only, shockingly, only had its Pride collection since 2018. One of the other things that I think is significant is that Disney donates profits from its Pride collection to specifically LGBTQIA+ organizations around the world. And it keeps a running list, a publicly available running list of the organizations that it supported. And I think that's kind of cool in terms of accountability.
Yeah, and in terms of, again, thinking about like what are the kinds of things that are likely to have been pushed by employees.
Exactly.
Because that's, you know, a dynamic that I think is really interesting here is like the kind of transformation of this corporation that happens because it has a lot of queer employees, and those employees are like holding it accountable or like pushing for things that aren't just about representation because they are about the employee experience.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the employee experience, though, Hannah, are you familiar with Disney's four keys?
Are those like four keys that the four owners of Disney turn simultaneously to blow up the world?
So I had not heard of these four keys either until starting to research this episode, but they're like foundational to employment at Disney. And so what I have for you to read, Hannah, is a quotation from a blog post by the Disney Experiences chairperson, Josh D'Amaro, where he explains their importance.
Will you tell me what Disney Experiences is?
It's like the term that they give for the person in charge of all of the stuff that you as the attendee experience.
Okay.
Or that you as the consumer of Disney would experience. So that is like, it includes like guest relations at parks. I think merchandise is affiliated with it. Disney's a weird web and they use weird terms for things.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Quote, every Disney Parks cast member, in parentheses here, they just call all of their employees cast members. I learned that on this trip.
Yeah.
Is familiar with our longstanding tradition of the four keys: safety, courtesy, show, and efficiency, which have guided our approach to guest service for more than 65 years. The four keys are one of the first things that cast members learn about when they join Disney Parks, experiences, and products, and they are regularly reinforced throughout their tenure. Each cast member is asked to use the four keys as the blueprint for the decisions they make during the workday and the approach they bring to their interactions with others. Cast members around the world know them by heart and live by them in their roles every day as they create amazing experiences for our guests, end quote.
Thank you. Thank you. So, according to D'Amaro's blog post, when employees around the world were asked how, quote, to bring a greater focus to inclusivity and belonging for our cast, end quote, the employees themselves suggested adding inclusion as a fifth key. And so given what D'Amaro has just described as being the importance and foundationalness of these four keys over the last 65 years, I think it's kind of a big deal that Disney was like, okay, we'll add a fifth key.
So they did.
They did.
They added inclusion.
Yep. And so this blog post that I had you just quote from is part of the soft launch of the fifth key, which is inclusion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean to Disney?
I'm glad you asked, Hannah, because I'm going to give you another quote to read. Take a sip of water because it's a long one.
Quote, our new approach provides greater flexibility with respect to forms of personal expression surrounding gender-inclusive hairstyles, jewelry, nail styles, and costume choices, and allowing appropriate visible tattoos. We're updating them to not only remain relevant in today's workplace, but also enable our cast members to better express their cultures and individuality at work. Moving forward, we believe our cast, who are at the center of the magic that lives in all our experiences, can provide the best of Disney's legendary guest service when they have more options for personal expression, creating richer, more personal, and more engaging experiences with our guests, end quote.
So the subtext here, I think, is we're not mandating our employees to look straight anymore.
Yeah.
Which I think is huge. I think it's a really big deal. And like, not just straight, but also like the thing about quote unquote appropriate visible tattoos is also like, well, there are people who have tattoos for cultural reasons.
Yeah. Same thing with hairstyles, right? Like hair and nail styles, jewelry, wearing visible tattoos. Like these are also ways that racism is encoded in corporate dress code practices. So there is definitely a sense here of like we are updating our understanding of what professional and appropriate dress looks like for our cast members. And that is something that is like, I would bet is driven by employees and by like, you know, by both current employees and by a desire to be an attractive employer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So this is all part of the inclusive fifth key. And I, you know, I left it stuff from the blog post about like, this is also part of why they're turning a racist old ride like Splash Mountain into Tiana's magical Bayou Adventure, whatever they're called. I don't know. It wasn't open when we went. But so it's all part of like a broad across the board campaign to be better, I say hesitantly.
Yeah. Oh, oh, so complicated.
I want to jump back to Dupla here in light of the examples of employee-driven change at Disney, because Dupla's research into municipal governance revealed that we can see meaningful LGBTQ plus inclusion when policies are developed by and in participation with queers and queer allies. So she extrapolates from her own findings to argue that, quote, it is through everyday practice of engagement within any institution, including academia, we'll dig there at you and me, Hannah, that we can collectively support the creation of safer queer spaces for marginalized segments of the community, end quote. It just, frankly, to me, doesn't seem that outlandish to suggest that inclusivity needs to start internally, you know?
Oh, Marcel, I have so many things I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe the easiest way to do it is by making you present a thesis that I can then dismantle.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that that's my favorite part of the episodes.
Let's do it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Alrighty, listeners, push up on your lap bars to make sure they've locked, because Marcel's theses can be loopy, unpredictable, and full of random turns.
If pinkwashing is by necessity surface-level public image campaigning that masks ongoing harm, Disney does seem to be doing something different. As one of the most powerful organizations in the world, founded on providing so-called family entertainment and expanding its market reach in an era that is gradually revealing itself to be a neoconservative hellscape, Disney really doesn't need to bend to the will of its queer consumers, or does it? The conservative boycott of Anheuser-Busch resulted in a mere 1% drop of the company's global sales. Target's stock price dip coincided with high inflation and general curtailing of discretionary spending. So maybe hateful ideologies simply don't have the spending power that they once did. That said, as queers and queer allies, we need to be mindful that capitalism wants us to treat our money as if it's an extension of our beliefs, as though this is natural or even desirable. And so when you think about it, the market is just finding new ways to make us pay for our own representation. In this essay,
I don't need to pick this apart as much as I claimed previously because it's full of ambivalence. But like, let's talk about that ambivalence because I hear it in your voice and I feel it in my soul, which is like this tension between saying this is an enormous corporation with a huge amount of power, with power so significant that it can create these quasi-public but still extremely private spaces that feel like cities when you're in them, to the point that the most comparable like example that you found, which I think is a legitimately comparable example, is like the municipal politics in the city of Geneva. But that tells us something about the way in which this massive corporation essentially approaches being a political body in and of itself, and that they are in many ways using their power to gently push LGBTQ plus inclusion as driven primarily by their employees, and that all of that is in fact symptomatic of a late capitalist hellscape.
Yeah, we live in hell, but at least we can get rainbow Mickey ears while we're there. That's where we're at, basically. We live in hell, but at least when we go to Disneyland and somebody calls us a slur, we can get a cast member to come and actually deal with it instead of being like, oh, I'm sorry, ma'am.
Yeah, I mean, not only can we get a cast member to come and deal with it, but then, like, the cast members who are overwhelmingly queer, like, make a real point of making sure that we know that we are welcome there and desired there and part of the community there, which, you know, is above and beyond a sort of corporate level policy, right? It's in part a reality of creating a space in which a lot of the people who work there are queer and trans and gender nonconforming, like that then actually in a meaningful material way makes the space safer for other queer people to go. I also can't, like, what is Disney doing politically in Florida? This is a question that's been on my mind that I absolutely haven't Googled, but I've been thinking about it in terms of, like, they know that a lot of the people, like probably a lot of Disney adults are queer, for example. And, you know, certainly we've seen that they're like influenced by decisions that are intended to keep them positioned as a really good employer for LGBTQ plus people. And obviously, the laws that are being passed in Florida right now make it both an incredibly unappealing place to live and work for queer and trans folks, and also an incredibly unappealing place, in fact, a dangerous place to visit for queer and trans folks. So, like, are they pushing back against those laws?
So, again, it's complicated because when we talk about Disney, we're talking about the corporate entity that is Disney. But as we've just been talking about, the experience of being at Disney is driven primarily by the cast members. So for folks who are uninitiated, the Disney World Resort, theme parks, hotels, everything all combined together is the resort, had a kind of special tax status in Florida up until recently. And it is also like run largely by queers, but like puppet mastered by a few straight white men up at the top.
Staffed largely by queers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Disney gives money and has given money to like every single Republican in the state of Florida. Disney is a donor, is a regular donor to the Republican Party, including to DeSantis. Like, Disney gave money to Governor Ron DeSantis during his campaign. And so, like,
do they also donate money to Democrats?
I don't know, because the articles that I was reading for this research didn't care. They were merely pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter in terms of the actual impact. I'm just curious if it's like at a corporate level, if it's just like, anyway.
And it very well could be.
They're probably donating money to every politician that they want to like them, which is every politician.
Yeah.
Because they want like laws passed that are, you know, favor them.
And I think it's also worth saying out loud that a lot of Democrats are also dirtbags. So,
for sure.
So, like,
undeniably.
So, the important thing is that Disney is a massive corporation that gives money to politicians, and those politicians use their power to enact actual harm by passing laws that prevent the discussion of non-heterosexuality in, say, classrooms, et cetera. So this is, I'm referring to the what's called the Don't Say Gay Bill. So when the Don't Say Gay Bill was up for debate, Disney employees were actively pushing then CEO Bob Chapek to speak out against it. And he did not. His approach was that they would be silent publicly, but would do more work internally and with the content they created to build a better world. And Disney employees threatened to walk out. They were upset about this. And then after it passed, after the Don't Say Gay Bill became law, Bob Chapek issued a public apology to those employees for his own silence. And in that public apology said, quote, "Starting immediately, we are increasing our support for advocacy groups to combat similar legislation in other states. We are hard at work creating a new framework for our political giving that will ensure our advocacy better reflects our values. And today, we are pausing all political donations in the state of Florida pending this review." End quote. There's more, but I'll leave it there.
And when was that?
This was March 11th, 2022.
Okay.
And Chapek was very shortly after that point removed from the head. And then Bob Iger, who was the previous CEO, was reinstated.
And like, he was like, we'll be reviewing nothing.
It's not like he's a gay angel. So it's complicated because I think for us as non-employees, it's easy to like look at this with a lot of sort of skepticism about how like, well, that means nothing. But on the other hand, it is a public statement by the CEO of Disney that they're not donating money because of this policy.
Well, but then he was removed right after.
Mm-hmm.
Was he removed for the statement or was he removed for...
Sorry, no, he was not removed for the statement. He was removed for a whole variety. People, shareholders were unhappy in general.
Okay.
Disney was losing money.
All right.
Can't have that.
Well, this is it. Like, shareholders will remove a person in control if they're losing money. And if they make decisions that are driven by employee satisfaction, but that result in conservative backlash that then results in fewer people going to the parks, then they're going to back off or they're going to fire that person. So like if their ultimate commitment is to the bottom line, this is what pinkwashing's about, right? It's like you'll do it insofar as it helps your business.
But Disney wasn't losing money because of conservative backlash because Bob Chapek was like, we're not going to donate money to the Republican Party. Disney was losing money because it had just come out of a two-year pandemic and people couldn't go to the parks. And also he wasn't a good guy. He implemented a whole bunch of things. He like made things that used to be included in the price of attending cost extra and stuff. So like, I don't want to give the impression that I'm a Bob Chapek apologist. I don't care about this
guy. No, and I don't like, you know, the individual white men in power mean very little to me. It's more sort of taking that step back and being like, at the end of the day, they're a business and they're going to make the decisions that are best for them as a business. And those decisions are not ultimately going to be driven by values. They're going to be driven by money.
I don't agree that they're not driven by values because I think making money is a value.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
But I see what you're saying.
Yeah. They're not going to be driven by any other values other than making money.
Exactly.
And this is, for me, where the whole public-private space thing comes in is, you know, so listeners, if you would like to hear more about some of the details of us getting hate-crimed at Disneyland, the bonus episodes that we've recorded talk about it in more detail. But I keep thinking about the angry white man insisting that he was allowed to use slurs because of his First Amendment right, and the response on the part of both Raimi, whose partner is a lawyer, and the cast members was, this is a private property. Your First Amendment rights don't apply here. And that is the way that they were arguing for, like, you're not allowed. Like, sure, you might be allowed to treat people like this as soon as you pass through the gates, but we have created a space that has many of the trappings of the public sphere, right? That, like, literally is, like, a simulacrum of the American public sphere, like downtown Disney, Main Street USA, but that is in fact a corporately owned and private space. And in this corporately owned private space, we get to decide what behavioral norms are allowed and not allowed. And that protection from the political environment of the country that we were in is part of what, at least for me, made me feel okay going on this trip when otherwise I'm like kind of scared of going to the U.S. right now.
Yeah, totally. I know.
But I was like, well, I won't, for the most part, I'll be inside this protected corporate bubble. And like, how does that both like create a space that feels good to be in, but also disincentivizes like engagement in the public sphere or caring about the laws that make actual public spaces that you don't have to pay hundreds of dollars to access safe for queer and trans people.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the hellscape, right? Like if you have a corporation that is by and large responding to its employees, gradually taking over the world, and those employees are by and large queer and queer allied, then sure, you can have a nice, magical, colorful world where people aren't allowed to hate crime you. But that is still a private space that you have to pay to access and is not the world that we live in. And so that's the rub. That's what's fucked.
That is what's fucked.
One of the things about Disney World in Florida is that it used to be that when you got off the plane and went to the, you know, got your bags and everything, there were Disney run buses there to take you directly to your hotel in the property. So it really was like, you are not in Florida. You are in Disney World.
At no point do you need to be here.
Yeah. So that's the ambivalence. That's the, yes, I like this and I like escaping from the real world, but I also kind of wish that the real world were not hate crimey.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the tension that I felt in general about how much I enjoyed myself. But like, a big part of why I enjoyed myself is because this space suspended so many of the things about day-to-day life that make it feel unlivable. And like, you know, this is, I'm currently very slowly listening to Jenny Odell's second book, Saving Time. And she's got a section in it on theme parks and on how much our generation likes spending money on immersive experiences more than we like spending money on things, because our time has become so profoundly commodified, broken down into these, you know, units of potential productivity that we are constantly trying to extract maximum value out of. And so the thing that makes the most sense to spend our money on is time. So like, we go to these parks to buy ourselves time outside of the like relentless grind of capitalism. But of course, ironically, that possibility for time is itself a product of everybody around us working.
And also paid for by our relentless grind.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sorry. We've reached the point in the episode where Coach simply must put an entire blanket over their head in despair. That's how we know we're really doing it. And while listening to that, I did have this like, will I end capitalism by not participating in this? You know, I get caught in these like theoretical loop-de-loops,
yeah,
of like, well, I don't think that I personally am going to end capitalism by boycotting Disney. And also the BDS movement has said that the better strategy to use in relation to Disney is to write letters, which we have all been doing, you know. So like, in terms of boycotting as a tactic, you know, that's at least one example of a political movement that has said boycott is not the tactic to use against this particular corporation. And also, like, it's very convenient that I have come up with a theoretical argument to support continuing to do a thing that I enjoyed. But, you know, then like, what kind of grim, pleasureless politics am I advocating for, where the possibility of joy doesn't play a role in my political existence as a subject? And you see how like, now I'm just like an Ouroboros, just having a little Ouroboros as a treat. And these are the traps that capitalism and its constraining of our imaginations have truly enclosed us in. But at the end of the day, Marcel,
mm-hmm,
I'm not convinced that what Disney's doing is pinkwashing.
I agree.
Yeah.
I don't think it's pinkwashing.
I don't think it's pinkwashing. It's something else. It's something very complicated and very messy,
mm-hmm,
but intriguingly, I don't think it's pinkwashing.
Yeah.
Well, we'll come up with a different name for it.
That's right. Imagineer something better.
Material Girls is a Witch Please production and is distributed by Acast. Why don't you enter a world of magic at owitchplease.ca, where you can find the rest of our episodes, access our transcripts, reading lists, and most importantly, our merch to commemorate your visit. We also have an excellent newsletter at owitchplease.substack.com and an even better Patreon at patreon.com/owitchplease. Speaking of the importance of capitalism, please give us money so that we can pay people. Our Disney bonus episode comes out next week, and Patreon is where you'll find part two of that episode, where we tell you all about being hate-crimed and our deep love for somebody named Robbie. You want to hear this story. So join today. We're also on Instagram, X, and Threads at Oh Witch Please, and on TikTok at Oh Witch Please Pod.
Thanks to Auto Syndicate for the use of our magical theme song, Shopping Mall. And of course, thanks to the whole Witch Please Productions cast. Our digital content coordinator, Gabby Iori. Our social media manager and marketing designer, Zoe Mix. our transcriber, Ruth Ormiston, and our executive producer, Hannah Rehack, a.k.a. Coach.
At the end of every episode, we will thank everyone who has joined our Patreon or boosted their tier to help make our work possible. Our enormous gratitude goes out to Jackie T, Get Nitty With It, Jeanette B, Emily L, Emily H, Atrachum Regina, Jennifer K, Florencia HV,
Hi Flo,
Izzy M, Catherine G, Eric, Lena, Ellie, Megan W, my friend. Megan's my friend. Hi, Megan. And Kayla D. We'll be back next episode to tackle another piece of pop culture through a whole new theoretical lens. But until then,
later, Disney animators.